All right. Good morning, everyone. Call to order the Tuesday, May 5th session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 202A. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you again. Senate Bill 202A supplements the definition of contractor in the Construction Contractor Board statutes to include a person who, for compensation, arranges, undertakes, offers to undertake, or submits a bid to clean or service chimneys.
Thank you very much. And again, for both the subcommittee as well as the public's interest, this is a version of this bill.
That's pretty good.
So, what's going on here?
The wife's nothing.
Mr. Chair, is this the puppy mill bill?
You noticed the strangled voice that was over there.
The chair didn't hear it, so I'm in good shape.
Mr. Chair, did you note the rather large crowd that we had this morning for this hearing?
Yes,
to testify on behalf of
anyone signed up?
Nobody signed up for any of our
anybody votes. Interested in testifying on Senate Bill 202A?
Chair, with Craig Smith with Construction Contractors Board.
Maybe we should have him say a word.
Since it's his bill, it might be a good idea.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. Today I'm joined by our policy analyst, Kathy Darlene. She's here to help answer some of the questions. Kathy was actually our lawyer for about almost 30 years and retired. We brought her back just part-time to help us with legislative session, and so she joins us, may have some questions today. Today we have three bills. I can't promise you a lot of controversy on these, and I can't promise you any fiscal impacts, but I should be able to promise you relatively brief testimony.
Okay.
Senate Bill 202A is a very simple bill. It started off a little more complicated, but there was obviously an amendment that took out a little policy issue. What this bill does is it simply relocates the information about chimney sweeps in the definition of construction contractors. We believe it makes the definition easier to read, and so we offer it to you. There was a vote in the Senate of 28 yeas with 2 nays. Again, no fiscal impact, and that concludes my testimony. May I answer any questions?
Questions or comments from the subcommittee? Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
It just doesn't seem right to not at least ask one question.
Please do.
What were the 2 nays for, Craig? I can't imagine.
It's a good question, Chair Witt and Representative Huffman. I have not had a chance to circle back with the 2 folks who voted against the bill, and I did not see the floor vote, so I can't answer that. Sometimes it's a bit of a mystery. And that's the best I can tell you, sir.
I'm not exactly seeing red flags jump out here. Just kind of curious.
I can tell you that if you don't know about the chimney sweeps are a great bunch of folks. They're not unlike the locksmiths. Mm-hmm. They're really good folks. Yeah. And what happened last session was there was a controversy because we had covered them by rule for 15 years or so and made them part of the CCB. They wanted regulation, and we got to looking at our statutory authority, and it became clear that we did not have statutory authority to regulate the chimney sweep industry, so we, by rule, took them out.
Was that
appropriately, I think. Well, that created a bit of a firestorm. And they got a little angry about that, and there was a bill dropped. And, of course, we're happy to regulate anybody you want us to, because that's your pleasure. And they came in, and they wanted to be regulated by CCB. The bill was dropped, and that was the end of that story from last session.
Very good. Additional questions or comments? Representative Polby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to actually just reiterate what Mr. Smith just told us, that the chimney sweeps last session did come in and were in favor of being regulated and licensed to bring some integrity to their industry, and my hat's off to them for that, and I support the bill before us.
Very good. Anything further, Vice Chair Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, I assume you mentioned its likeness to the locksmith, so I assume as far as any, and I didn't read through, it says no expenditure impact or anything, so I assume the person to oversee this is covered by the fees, and so there's no fiscal related.
Chair Hoffman, I'm sorry, Chair Witt, Representative Hoffman, the chimney sweeps did not want that kind of regulation. They simply wanted to have the ability to have the businesses that they operate be construction contracting businesses. They didn't want any special training, any special certification, any special continuing education. That might come at a later date. If they did, it might bear some cost and some looking at. They simply wanted to be able to have a CCB number and have a bonded insurance the way construction contractors have.
Okay, thanks.
Anything additional? Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 202A, and I'm going to open a work session on that bill. Subcommittee members, anyone?
Would you entertain a...
Please, Vice Chair Huffman.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 202A to the floor with a due pass recommendation, to the full Committee on Business and Labor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Huffman moves Senate Bill 202A to the full Committee on Business and Labor. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none, hearing none, motion passes. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 202A, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 204. And Patrick, when you get a chance to do your paper shuffle there.
I've got it, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senate Bill 204 clarifies that CCB residential bonds will be applied to pay claims against residential contractors, and commercial bonds will be applied to pay claims against commercial contractors. This measure has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Thank you very much. And Craig, once again.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and today I'm joined by Kathy Darlene, a policy analyst for the board. The House Senate Bill 204, again, is a relatively simple bill. It would clear up some confusion regarding the new bonds that we have as a result from last session, House Bill 3242, which was the Associated General Contractors Commercial Contracting Act that separated commercial contractors from residential contractors. During the next year, and starting actually about a year ago, contractors, as they register, have to make a choice. Are they going to be a commercial person or a residential person, or are they going to be both? The major difference between those two groups is going to be a bond that they're going to have. And the bond we've developed after last session, but there's some question about whether or not a person, after they have filed a dispute, and on the commercial side they'll go through court, and on the residential side they'll go through the CCB. If after a decision has been made, if payment could be made on a residential complaint against a commercial bond and vice versa. That's not as clear as we'd like to see it. We think clarity is what you want. We think that you want just the commercial complaints to be coming out of the commercial bond and, again, vice versa. And I think that will affect the ultimate price of those bonds. So the clarity, I think, will help the market in what is charged for those bonds. And certainly we think that there is no dispute here as to what your policy was or what you wanted it to be. So we offer this bill just for clarity's sake.
Thank you very much. Questions? Comments? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, on the situation where you're describing a contractor that's endorsed as both residential contractor and a commercial contractor, they don't have two separate bonds, or do they?
Chair Witt and Representative Holby, in fact, they do have each a they would have a bond for commercial work and a bond for residential work.
Okay, and so this just clarifies that if it's a commercial undertaking that they're doing, that if there's a claim on a commercial, it goes against commercial. If there's a claim, if they're working on a residential structure, then the claim would go against the residential bond, essentially.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, am I correct in remembering that in 2007, AGC and some others approached the body to kind of set this up to where there would be two different bonds, residential? Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
Yes.
And this, and I agree, this does make sense since we passed that in 07, that this clarify. And yeah, you would think it might, if any impact, might even lessen the fee impact to contractors, maybe.
Chair Witt and Representative Huffman, your memory is correct. It was the Associated General Contractors and the folks from the trades that co-sponsored that legislation, and we do believe that there could be an adverse unintended consequence if for some reason a court were to find that a residential bond was subject to payment for a commercial complaint. So we, this is, of course, we're trying to get ahead of the game. We're trying to solve problems before they happen, particularly if there's no downside. We think this bill has no downside.
Anything further? Representative Dembro.
I think there are cases, and certainly there's some legislation that's looking at mixed kinds of construction situations where part of the project would be commercial and the other would be residential. So there, if there were damages to be claimed against a bond, it would depend on where the problem was, which part of that project, and does that complicate things?
Chair Witt and Representative Dembrow, it does slightly complicate the problem, and to make an even finer point on it, there is a middle ground, what we call a small commercial structure, and a small commercial structure can be covered by either bond, and the complainant would need to choose which forum they wanted to go through in that case.
Is there something on the chart? Am I seeing you looking at, is there?
Chair Representative Dembrow, there is one other way that we sort this out, we parse this out. We look at the definition sections. The statute defines what's a residential structure, what's a small commercial structure, and what's a large commercial structure. And what you're talking about...
Ms. Dolling, if you would please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Kathy Dolling. I'm the policy analyst for the Construction Contractors Board. And when you're talking about mixed use, I think, is what we would look to, actually, is we would look to these definitional sections first to try to determine which one it falls in. It's not as a real simple thing, but it can be sorted out that way.
Anything further? Yes, Representative Colby.
Just to clarify what we were just told, then it's very possible that we could have a residential structure that's 30 stories tall that would be under a commercial type of bond.
Representative Witt, Representative Holvey, 20 stories probably not, because a residential structure is defined as containing one or more dwelling units 4 stories or less above grade. But if you're talking about a 3-story structure, you might, yeah.
So, I mean, to clarify, a 30-story residential building would be a commercial
structure.
Would
be a large commercial structure,
right.
That's right.
Kind of what I was getting at. Thank you.
That's true.
Anything more?
I'm not seeing or hearing anything. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 204 and open a work session on the same bill. Subcommittee members, your pleasure.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 204 to the full Committee on Business and Labor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Huffman moves Senate Bill 204 to the full Committee on Business and Labor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Not hearing anything. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, hearing none, the motion passes. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 204. And give me a moment to shuffle some papers here. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 206. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 206 makes personal identifier information provided in license or certification application to CCB confidential. It prohibits disclosure of Social Security numbers, driver license numbers, date of birth, and other personal identification required for licensure. It provides exceptions, however. It exempts construction contractor from submitting personal identifier information to CCB if the contractor offers securities registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. It exempts the contractor that is in partnership or joint venture offering securities registered with SEC from obtaining new contractor license upon withdrawal of partner or venturer. This measure also has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Thank you very much. Deja vu all over again, Representative Esquivel. With that, Craig, you're on.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board, and again today I'm joined by policy analyst Kathy Dullin. And Kathy actually helped with a lot of this issue over the last several years. This bill does do two important things that we'd like to bring to you for your consideration today. Two separate problems. First problem is a risk that our licensees have for identity theft. And, of course, that's a big deal in a lot of different forums. And our licensees worry about that. The law does allow the board, and the board does obtain personal identifiers for the owners of the construction businesses that we license. That's important to us because, frankly, there's a lot of John Smiths. There's a lot of Craig Smiths. In fact, I've got two Craig Smiths that work at the Construction Contractors Board. So it's possible, particularly in our industry, where you have one person that gets a bad reputation, and then that name shows up trying to get licensed. We need a way to separate those two people, so we must have the identifiers. And we do get some pushback from our licensees or our applicants about giving up that information. But we have to have it. But we have to have it secure. Today, they would be subject to, we believe, a public records request. And, of course, we get a number of public records requests. And it would be very unfortunate if we had to give out that information, particularly on a lot of folks that have given up that information to us. This bill would make it clear that that's not the way it's done in Oregon, that that information would be confidential. And I'm talking about Social Security numbers, dates of birth, and Oregon driver's license numbers. We would still provide the names of individuals that own companies that we believe is a reasonable thing to have on file and available to the public. But the owner's dates of birth and obviously Social Security numbers we think should be off limits. If you move this bill forward, that would make that confidential. The other thing it does is it solves a different problem that we have. This problem is for larger companies, and we license a number of larger companies that have different business needs and have different risks in our state than do some of the smaller, closely family-held businesses that we regulate. The larger companies that I'm talking about, a company like IBM, perhaps Lowe's, perhaps some other larger companies, today are subject to the same laws as the smaller businesses as it relates to our acquisition of the names of all their owners and officers. Well, in a company like IBM, who came into Oregon here just a few years ago and needed to get a contractor's license, and when we told them that we needed the names and address and then personal identifiers of all of their corporate officers, all of their owners throughout the world, well, it didn't make a whole lot of business sense. Those are not the kind of businesses that have trouble, dump the corporation and then start a new one, like some of the smaller companies that unfortunately get into trouble with us that we have to track. So we had to try to find a way to say a larger company that has different, perhaps, regulatory needs, we would handle in a different format than the smaller companies. And frankly, with Kathy's help and others, we found a way. And that way is to suggest to you that if a company is registered with the SEC, where they do have to give up the names of their and addresses of their owners and officers to the federal government, and they have them on file, that those folks would not have to give that same kind of information to CCB. They'd have to establish that they're registered with the SEC, and if they did, we would not get the names and addresses and personal identifiers of their owners and officers. That would help with a small number of large companies. It would also help the CCB, because just even managing those records is tough for us, let alone tough for the business. So that's a streamlining measure. That's in essence what this bill would do. Protect the identifiers that we have for the small business people and allow larger companies that are registered with the SEC not to have to give up that information. Can I answer any questions?
Committee members? Representative Colby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Craig. I appreciate you coming and talking to me about this bill. As you know, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, as I said, I was kind of curious about how accessible the SEC information would be to the CCB, and certainly I wouldn't expect that you'd have a lot of trouble getting that information if you needed it. However, I also am just a little concerned about the individual company that's operating in Oregon, that there is what we used to call the responsible managing responsible managing individual. So do we still have a responsible managing individual for these companies in the state of Oregon that has some sort of liability for the actions of this company?
Right. And Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, I'm going to punt on that. Kathy's worked with the what we call the RMI rule a little bit. And she also knows about the access. I chatted with her a little bit about the access to that information. So starting with the responsible managing individual, let me set this up by saying that's a term of art that we use in statute that relates to the person, usually an owner of the business, can be an employee, that is the person that takes the test or otherwise qualifies the business to get a license because of that person's experience. And every business that we register in Oregon or license in Oregon has one of those. And so with that said, if Kathy has some thoughts.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, for the record, my name is Kathy Dahling. I'm the policy analyst for the Construction Contractors Board. Regarding the responsible managing individual, the companies that are exempt would not necessarily have to give us necessarily the information in the same format, but they would still have to have a responsible managing individual. All companies that are going to be licensed have to have one. So that doesn't substantively change. Regarding the question about access to information from the SEC, what we're aware of is that there are a large number of public filings that the SEC makes relating to who are their officers, owners, directors who have a fairly significant interest. These filings are generally available to any member of the public. We get this information usually on the front end in our applications and don't necessarily run any particular kind of background checks at that point in time. You know, from any contractor, we just obtain the information. But later, if we need to look back at it, if we suspect somebody's given us misinformation, that's when we get into looking backwards into the applications. And in this case, we would be doing the same thing. We could go get the SEC filings and look backwards into those if we suspect for some reason something is amiss that we need to look at. Craig gave you a bit of background. This originally came to us as a problem with IBM because they have a multitude of vice presidents, as do many large corporations, and they just, you know, trying to get dates of birth, personal identifiers, notify us every time there was a change was really cumbersome. We also have one of the very large home builders, I think it was Centex, also came with the same problem, and so did Home Depot. So we've actually had this issue arise with several of these businesses. And like Craig pointed out, our concern has always been trying to track people who will form a business, leave their debts behind, and go form another business, leave their debts behind, go form another business, leave their debts behind. We're trying to track those guys. Nobody's going to form IBM and then just, you know, get rid of it to avoid construction contractor debt. So it's just not really a problem we have to face.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I know that it's really not in the purview of this bill, the RMI concept, but getting back to that RMI, that will be registered for companies like this in the state of Oregon, does that individual supply similar information? And I guess does not that RMI also have some sort of liability for the actions of the company?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, there would be the way the statute is proposed, it wouldn't apply if you were one of these large companies, and what the exemption would be, it would include the name and address of the responsible managing individual designated by the applicant. That being said, there would still need to be a responsible managing individual. And I think probably as a practical matter, we're still asking for the name in every case of those people. There isn't really a liability that runs from those folks for the corporation's actions because they are corporations. There's no individual person who's liable. But if they don't have one of these folks, if they don't have a responsible managing individual, then we won't license them. That's the thing that applies to the corporation or the business.
And one more. And just so I heard that correctly, so the responsible managing individual isn't subject to having these identifiers, even though you may redact them, but when the company gets the license, doesn't that RMI also have to have, you know, name, address, you know, all of that information to the CCB?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, as a general rule, yes, they do. They would normally do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I never would add this question before Representative Holvey started pursuing this, but now I'm curious, who would, for an IBM or a Home Depot, who would the RMI be typically for them? Would it be like a state-appointed VP or...
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, in the case of IBM, they actually had an individual employee who was in Oregon, who was a contractor, had that kind of a background. They selected him to take the training, to take the test, and to become the RMI. It's usually an employee of the company is who it would be. The responsible managing individual isn't... Not, for example, they're not like a registered agent that accepts service or something in that order. They're more an individual that's significant because it means you have at least one person in your operation, and admittedly this is more important if you're small probably than a large operation, who has some background and knowledge about contracting and particularly the laws regarding contracting in Oregon.
Follow up. So it's more for to have a contact person rather than somebody that's actually responsible for day-to-day business, somebody in charge, per se.
Well, I think Chair Witt and Vice Chair Huffman, in most cases, the responsible managing individual is simply the person who has taken the test or qualifies the business to be licensed. We have changed the rules a little bit so that person is now, in most cases, responsible for the debt as well. And we did that because we had some situations where it appeared as if the folks were skirting their liability by really behind the scenes being an RMI, but keeping off the books as it relates to being a owner or officer of the corporation. So what I'd like to do is to get back to you on the case of the larger businesses that have RMIs. I think that the way we have organized the law at this point, that RMIs are responsible for most, in most cases, just like owners and officers. But I'm a little unclear about that issue, so I want to get back to you about that.
You don't need to. I was just kind of curious as to what the information link was there, and as far as responsible parties, I guess, more than, but it's
okay.
Fine.
Okay. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have much concern about the larger organizations because, like you said, they don't come and go like a traveling show. My concern is the contractor that comes in that's lost its, he's lost, he or she has lost their license in two or three other states, and yet we still license them. What steps have we taken to correct that? Because this is the same thing we talked about in 2005 session, that I had a concern because we had a contractor that lost their license in California, Nevada, and I believe Arizona, and came into Oregon and burnt a couple banks again for the fourth time and was heading for Washington, I believe, and in business in Washington within a short period of time. Yeah. What have we done as a state to correct these bad players and correct these people that are, they just walk away from it, they file bankruptcy, and then they open up business the next day in another state with no consequences?
Right. Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, it's a great question. It's an issue that comes up regularly. We don't like that, I think, in the state of Oregon, obviously. And gives Representative Holvey some credit with in the Task Force on Construction Claims, dealt with that issue over since 2005. And there's a couple of things that occurred. The large bill that came out of the Task Force on Construction Claims provided us with a number of solutions for that problem. The definition, or allowing us to look at whether a contractor is fit or unfit and to write rules about that. The ability to seek information about whether or not owners or officers have been licensed in other states and whether they are responsible for court judgments in other states helps us with that. And we ask whether or not they have had licenses and whether or not they, there are unpaid court judgments from other states. On top of that, one of the things that happens that you may or may not be aware of is that state contractor licensing agencies, like so many government agencies that have counterparts in other states, have an association. And so its acronym is the word NASCLA, and it has a database that is in all the states, and most states participate. And so what we do when we get an applicant is we run those names and determine whether or not that applicant has been revoked in other states and is in the NASCLA database as such. And if it shows a hit, and it usually doesn't, but if it shows a hit, we go even deeper. On top of that, we ask about court judgments or other construction debts, and if those debts aren't paid, we take another second look at that applicant and may not license it. And we catch quite a few. I can't tell you we catch everyone. I can't tell you that everybody is 100% on their application. When we do find someone has provided us with false information through a variety of different checks and balances that sometimes raise up and catch folks who have provided misinformation, we also suspend licenses. And in some cases, have the authority to revoke a license. When there's a bankruptcy involved, we have a special problem. As you know, the nature of bankruptcy is a fresh start. But that doesn't mean that a applicant can have a fresh start without increasing its protections for Oregonians. So we do have statutory authority that we believe works well. Under certain circumstances, if a person, an individual, has been responsible for a significant amount of unpaid construction debt and claims and pain for Oregon consumers, we can require any new business that person starts to have a larger bond than a person who didn't have that kind of a history. So even when there is a bankruptcy, we can have a greater degree of protection for consumers. And frankly, in some cases, that protection is not affordable for the person that filed the bankruptcy. So we can't keep them out because they filed a bankruptcy, nor should we probably be able to, but we do increase the financial protections for Oregonians when it appears as though that's the thing to do.
Follow up, please. So whenever anyone applies in the state of Oregon, we run them through a data bank, period. Doesn't matter who they are, doesn't matter what's on their application. We do that as a matter of practice and policy.
Chair Witt and Representative Escoval, we do run the applicant's name through the database, the national database from NASCA.
Anything further? I'm not seeing anything. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 206, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 206.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 206 to the full Committee on Business and Labor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Vice Chair Huffman moves Senate Bill 206 to the full Committee on Business and Labor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, hearing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing or hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you very much. I'm going to close a work session on Senate Bill 206. And thank you very much. Certainly appreciate your assistance here this morning. In terms of coming events, Patrick's probably unfamiliar with our schedule. But as far as I know, Keith, we're on tap for an informational hearing Thursday morning beginning at 8 o'clock.
That's correct.
And do you have any further background on the group that's coming in? Not trying to put you on the spot.
Not yet.
Okay, very good. Anything else for the good of the order? Not seeing anything. We're adjourned until Thursday morning. Thanks very much, everybody.